People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio. Today we're going to be talking to a conductor, Perry So, who was born in Hong Kong. He's based in Boston. He's received the first and special prizes at the 5th International Prokofiev Conductor Competition in St. Petersburg and has won numerous other awards. And we're going to find out all about him. But importantly, Perry So is in Cape Town conducting a series of 3 concerts with the Cape Town Philharmonic Orchestra. So Maestro, so welcome. It's good to have you. And I'm glad you had some time to come and speak to us.
Rodney, so thank you so much for having me.
It's a great pleasure. And also, I know it's not your first visit, and you visited South Africa before, haven't you? Not only Cape Town.
I believe this is my 5th visit to the country. I first came in 98, I believe, as a high school student with my high school orchestra from Hong Kong. And it was, I was entirely ravished by the country. We went to Kruger, we went to Robben Island. I saw the immense diversity in the beauty and the complexity of the history of this country, and have loved coming back ever since. Okay. And actually recently, just a couple of months ago, I was in Durban and Johannesburg.
Okay, well, it's good to welcome you back to Cape Town. And I know famously you did you recorded an award-winning CD with the Korngold Violin Concerto with the violinist Gilmore. What was his first name?
Alex Gilman, yes.
Alex Gilman, which was hugely well-received internationally, wasn't it?
I believe so, and I look back on that very fondly, actually. I mean, it was the first time I ever met the Cape Town Philharmonic. This was in 2010, I believe. And we had 4 long days in the studio, but it was a wonderful recording experience because for me, the orchestra was of one mind as to getting it right. As we know in the world, it's sometimes quite difficult to get 2 people to agree on one thing.
I was going to say, let alone an entire orchestra.
Exactly. So that experience really stayed with me, and I've enjoyed coming back ever since.
But that must be very good, because sometimes there can be tricky relationships between conductors and orchestras. Famously, orchestral members complain about conductors, but it does seem as though you have a good working relationship. And I believe that it shows in the performances, which is a compliment to you, but I'm sure you agree.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that. I was always told that if you can get 51% of a group of people to agree with you, then basically you've gotten as good as you can get.
And your first concert, Perry, with the orchestra, with Raphael Wolfisch playing the cello concerto by Dvorak, had a most curious second half. And I thought, what? The cycle of tone poems, Ma Vlast, My Homeland by Smetana. And although there are 6 and we've heard 4, what on earth made you choose that? And look what we've discovered as a result.
Programming for me is a rather tortured process. I'm trying to balance a couple of things. You know, of course, firstly, what I think the orchestra can play well and present well to the audience. And secondly, what I guess the audience might enjoy. And then thirdly, you know, something that tickles my fancy. And when we discussed putting together a Slavic program with the Dvorak cello concerto, I mean, a number of different options came up. Tchaikovsky, more Dvorak, perhaps some Polish music. But I had been thinking a lot, actually, about Smetana. And recently, actually, for many years, I've been doing the Moldau, but never really quite understood its context. Mm-hmm. And I think it's part of my slightly inquisitive nature about the historical context of the music that I perform, that I started studying Ma Vlast, and was both, I both fell in love with the piece, but was also taken aback by the strange complexity in the music, and thought that it was a really weird thing to have at that point in the development of let's say nationalist music, yes. where a lot of these aesthetic boundaries were being transcended, and I thought, well, you know, there's a polka in that fourth the fourth tone poem. There's that beautiful opening to the first tone poem. There's that, you know, this exciting kind of martial theme in the sixth movement. what's not to love?
Exactly. And it's scored for a rather large orchestra. He really demonstrates his skill as an orchestrator, doesn't he? That's what struck me listening to it the other night. You hear the most amazing colors, the most amazing textures in really quite a large orchestra.
And what is most amazing was that he was entirely deaf when he wrote all
this. I know, this is the extraordinary thing, to get all that color. And if we talk about the Moldau, which everyone knows, which is the second movement, yes, as such, the vivid descriptive writing, whether it's the water coming out of the ground or the flutes, whether it's the stream going over rapids, passing castles, the orchestration is unbelievable, and to think he was deaf is even more extraordinary.
It's exquisitely written, and I have maybe a slightly unorthodox view that our perception that this should be played by a large orchestra is something that's been set up for us by the tradition, mm-hmm. and I don't necessarily think that that is a given. With the Cape Town Philharmonic, where we have a slightly smaller string grouping than say, some Czech orchestras that usually play this music, I actually think we get a clarity and an understanding of the multiplicity of the textures,
yes,
in a way that if you have 85 people on stage and there's a lot more sound, mm-hmm. It might be slightly more difficult to get the counterpoint and the layering. So I'm very glad to have done it, especially with this size of a group.
Was it the first time you'd done it as a conductor, or have you? Because you said you'd been studying it and thinking about it for a while now.
It is the first time I've done it. It's a difficult thing to program. Not everyone bites.
Right. No, I'm very glad you did. I think you've introduced people to a whole. Afterwards, at the after party thing, people were saying, "Why do we not hear more of this music?" So it really hit home, I should think.
I'm very glad to hear
and
that.
And I'm sure that clarity had a lot to do with you, because we have, obviously, as you know more than anyone else, balance problems because of the brass and woodwind with a relatively small string section. So I think conductors have to be very careful how they deal with that.
I think that's a problem that is quite universal. Mm-hmm. It's just the sheer construction of the instruments.
Yes, absolutely.
That disadvantages the strings.
Yeah. Perry, so is my guest, and I'm going to ask you now, Perry, what your first piece of music is going to be to share with us.
It's going to be the finale, the Liebestod of Tristan and Isolde by Richard Wagner.
Good grief. Well, I'm going to ask you why. I know why I would choose it, because it's such an extraordinary piece of music. But why have you chosen it specifically?
For me, Tristan and Isolde is the ultimate. Perfect marriage of drama and music and poetry. And there's something almost superhuman about this music. It's the music that I keep coming back to whenever tragedy or difficulty strikes. I go back and I find in this music a life force and a will to live and to love that other composers have, but I think Wagner captured it in this opera in a very, very unique way.
Well, you've chosen this fantastic recording with the great Carlos Kleiber and Margaret Price, who would probably never sing it on stage, but he wanted her in to sing it as a studio recording. So here is the Liebestod, which ends Tristan und Isolde by Wagner. That's the sort of music where you don't quite sure what to say afterwards. And even having just heard that last moment, it works its spell, doesn't it? Let alone having heard the whole opera and then hearing that after 5 hours. The closing, the Liebestod, Isolde's Liebestod from Tristan und Isolde by Wagner. Carlos Kleiber was conducting with Margaret Price as soloist. And it was the choice of my guest, the conductor Perry So, who's in Cape Town at the moment conducting the orchestra here. And it's a great pleasure to have you because I know you're busy. We're recording this interview on a day that you should be off and able to look around the city. So thank you, Perry, for coming in.
It's my pleasure.
Have you ever conducted Tristan, by the way?
I've never done the opera entire, but I discovered many years ago a suite, an orchestral suite with no singers, that was arranged by a Dutch percussionist.
My goodness.
Which takes what for me are some of the best bits, the best orchestral bits actually, mm-hmm. particularly. So it begins with the prelude and ends with the Liebestod and has a lot of the most memorable music in between. And it's a very interesting thing to do for an orchestra that might be preparing a production of it.
Oh, okay.
Because it telescopes the whole plot and all of the main motifs of the opera into one symphonic whole.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, actually, really reminds me that Wagner was actually a tremendous symphonic composer. He just, I mean, after that first symphony, which he wrote when he was 20, yes. whatever, I mean, he just never went back to it again.
And just as well, because that symphony, as fun as it is to listen to, is so not typical Wagner, isn't it?
It's not him at all.
It's too influenced by Beethoven, really. But, I mean, the Ring Cycle, for example, one of the things I love about the Ring Cycle is the symphonic development that happens all the way through. He's developing themes as one would in a symphony, in a sonata form symphony. I remember someone once telling me it's like a huge symphony with Rheingold as the first movement, Walküre as what would be the slow movement, Siegfried, a sort of scherzo, and then the great finale where all the themes come together. How about that? Have you done any of The Ring?
No, I haven't. But that makes a lot of sense to me, especially as Siegfried as a scherzo. That does make a lot of sense to me. The thing with Wagner that I've discovered, I mean, not having done any of the operas in the theater, but it's exactly this thing where the orchestra becomes a character, an active character in the story. Mm-hmm. And it does add a level of dramatic interest that I think composers up till that point had not quite discovered yet. And then, of course, subsequently, you see many composers discovering this in the wake of Wagner's music.
Like Richard Strauss, notably.
Also Tchaikovsky, in fact.
Yes. Oh, there you go. Thank you. I'm glad you said that, because I'm also a huge Tchaikovsky fan. And isn't it irritating when people say he's vulgar or something, because it means they don't really understand it?
But Tchaikovsky is the Mozart of Russian music. Mm-hmm. He's the foundation and also a composer of broad imagination and also so fundamental to the way that Russian music developed. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why anyone wouldn't love him.
Exactly. And then we were talking about Smetana and his orchestration earlier. I mean, how about Tchaikovsky, the orchestrations of those ballets, Nutcracker, and also the symphonies? As much as he said he battled with symphonic form, who could live without 4, 5, and 6, and even 2?
Absolutely. I'm actually working right now on Onegin, and I'm discovering exactly this thing that led us to this topic, that the orchestration is so carefully thought through for every single dramatic moment, mm-hmm. and illustrates both emotion and plot and also direction. And it's a work of genius and somehow underrated still.
I know. But it's interesting you say Eugene Onegin, because that, like the Wagner operas, is structured in a rather unusual way, isn't it? It's not the typical opera. It's almost a hybrid, isn't it?
The best analogy that I've read is that it's almost like Greek tragedy, where you know that the audience knows the plot exactly coming in.
Yeah.
And that's Pushkin's Onegin, which the audience would have known intimately. And the point of the performance is to illustrate particular scenes and particular emotions within it, and also to show this particular artist's interpretation of that initial text. And I was once a student of literature, and this opera fascinates me for that reason, that it is an artistic act as an interpretation of another artistic work. This kind of snake eating its own tail.
Yes, you made me want to go and listen to it over again, to listen to it with new ears. Thank you, maestro. So, just before your next piece of music, I'm interested, you said about literature, I see that you have a degree in comparative literature from Yale University, and that's sort of, I was going to say a long way from music, but then you sort of think, having just spoken about Eugene Onegin, it's not actually.
I think, you know, the division of the disciplines and humanities, you know, what they talk about as a kind of fall from grace when people from different disciplines stop talking to each other, is something that I was aware of very early, that actually musicians and literary scholars and historians and philosophers and psychologists, we actually all have a lot in common. I mean, the methods that we use often have changed over time and have kind of departed from each other. But the central concerns, I think, have always remained the same.
I remember reading somewhere that a composer manipulates your mind and your feelings. It's the same as a therapist with a psychologist, a philosopher. Indeed. They manipulate us. And we love to be manipulated, don't we? So I mean that very positively.
Yes, and from my point of view, it's also about texts. Mm. We read the world. I mean, even when we walk down the streets, in a way, we're trying to read the world. And that's where the literature has been very helpful to me for music, that I can think about musical text as something that has specific meanings and not just technical challenges.
Absolutely. It gives a depth, doesn't it, to your interpretations, I dare say.
I hope so.
Well, we're going to find out more about your background and how you came to music in a moment and about Hong Kong. But what is your next piece? I see a bit of a contrast with from Wagner to Rameau.
Absolutely.
Or is it? But it is, yes, of course.
Well, it's also opera. But it's another one of my great loves, which is the Baroque, and especially the French Baroque. And Jean-Philippe Rameau wrote a good number of operas, over 20, but also there were opera ballets. And his final work, Les Boréades, was never performed in his lifetime. And I think in it is some of the most ravishing, charming music that's ever been written.
What are we going to hear from it?
Let's have the contradance.
Well, the distinctive sound of Rameau there, one of the contradances from his very last opera called
Les Boréades.
Les Boréades. My guest, Perry So, the conductor, who's in Cape Town, conducting the Cape Town Philharmonic in the spring season. It was his second choice on People of Note this week. And Perry, I said the distinctive sound, but Rameau, it's almost one of those composers that you can immediately say, that's Rameau, more than any of the other French Baroque composers. Would you agree?
I agree, absolutely.
Amazing color and whistles and bell sounds in his music.
Well, first of all, he used the piccolo like no one else before him did. Mm-hmm. So I think he just had exactly this wonderful sonic imagination for the highs and the absolute lows, and then also just these weird chords that he throws in.
Yes, it's quite modern, in fact, when you hear it.
And I think just very joyful that he, maybe because he came to it late in life, he became a huge success when he was about 50 or so.
Oh, gosh.
That I guess he maybe felt like he had nothing else to lose.
Yes, so let's experiment a bit. But regarding repertoire, you said just now, we were talking about opera, then you said how much you like Baroque music, and especially the French Baroque. Do you get much chance to conduct the wider repertoire?
I try to be something of an advocate for bringing that music back into the symphonic repertoire.
Okay.
I think it's it's slightly unfortunate. I'm a huge fan of a lot of things that have happened in the historically informed performance movement. And I myself was a harpsichordist earlier in life. And so I really appreciate that we've taken a much more scholarly, but at the same time, maybe slightly more honest approach to that music than maybe has been the case in the past. But the terrible thing is that those of us in the mainstream don't really feel legitimized to perform that music as much as we used to do. And I think that really is a shame. Mm-hmm. I think symphony orchestras can have a lot to say in Bach and Rameau and Handel. And it's something that I'm trying to, just with the right opportunities, to try to change the perception that only the early music groups should be playing this music. I think we all can be.
Of course, but I mean, that's interesting you should say that, because some conductors are. Simon Rattle famously uses period instrument techniques, even with the Berlin Philharmonic. I saw a Beethoven cycle with him, and I was astonished at the textures. Not much vibrato, but in other words, the historically informed using modern instruments. When it comes to tempo and phrasing and textures, you can do on a modern orchestra.
Well, that's been one of the most inspiring examples to me, that the Berlin Philharmonic has, as one of the bastions of the old tradition, taken on so much of what has been learned in the last 40 years. Mm-hmm. But it's, for me, it's still somewhat of a rarity. I mean, the top orchestras do it, but I especially where I live in North America, it's a little less common to see that.
Okay.
And it's both an aesthetic and a psychological hurdle for musicians who have been used to playing in a romantic style to suddenly switch to not using vibrato. And maybe there's a, you know, in the major European cities, especially in Amsterdam and in Berlin, there are wonderful period ensembles, and these ensembles all speak to each other.
Yes.
Whereas
yes.
I think that is a little bit less the case in some other places, and it's something that I would love to see more of.
Okay, well, here's a challenge. Why don't you, when you next hear, do a Rameau suite? You know, those Anacreon. There are all these suites that have been recorded from his operas with about, 10, 15 short movements.
Absolutely, and that is something that I do bring around with me, so I will take on that challenge.
Because it will be interesting how this orchestra adapts to that, especially that sound of Rameau, as we said, with the whistles and the piccolos and the percussion. It's a unique sound which has to be produced.
Well, and I think the thing to remember is that we don't obviously have recordings of the late 1700s.
No.
So everything that we think of as being, quote, unquote, authentic is a reconstruction through some means, scholarship, eyewitness accounts. Mm-hmm. And in a way, that's very freeing.
Yes.
That we can take the evidence that has been laid out in front of us and make our own decisions and come to our own conclusions about how this should be performed.
Exactly. But not get too obsessed by it, because I think
precisely
the period instrument movement had a phase of, it almost seemed obsessive, that everything was played faster and everything was played with absolutely no vibrato and wooden flutes and wooden oboes.
So, right.
And timpani with those lovely hard sticks, which actually were terribly thrilling. Anyway, yes. Your next piece of music, Perry, is a little bit of a surprise. So why have you chosen this? Tom Lehrer.
Yes, so I live in Boston, and one of our heroes in Boston was the mathematics professor and songwriter Tom Lehrer. A brilliant man in many, many ways, and he, as a bit of a side gig from teaching at Harvard, would write these little ditties and perform them singing with himself at the piano. And I've chosen the song Lobachevsky, which appeals to my love for Russia. It's about a Russian mathematician who has stolen an idea for an award-winning paper through a number of intermediaries all across Siberia.
Who made me the genius I am today, the mathematician that others all quote? Who's the professor that made me that way, the greatest that ever got chalk on his coat? One man deserves the credit, one man deserves the blame, and Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky is his name. Hey, Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky! I am never forget the day I first meet the great Lobachevsky. In one word, he told me secret of success in mathematics. plagiarize. Plagiarize. Let no one else's work evangelize. Remember why the good Lord made your eyes. So don't shade your eyes, but plagiarize, plagiarize, plagiarize. Only be sure always to call it, please, research. And ever since I meet this man, my life is not the same. And Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky is his name. Hey, Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky. I'll never forget the day I'm given first original paper to write. It was on analytic and algebraic topology of locally Euclidean metrization of infinitely differentiable Riemannian manifold. Boże moi. This I know from nothing. But I think of great Lobachevsky and I get idea. I have a friend in Minsk who has a friend in Pinsk, whose friend in Omsk has friend in Tomsk with friend in Akmolinsk. His friend in Alexandrovsk has friend in Petropavlovsk, whose friend somehow is solving now the problem in Dniepropetrovsk. And when his work is done, begins the fun. From Dniepropetrovsk to Petropavlovsk, by way of Ilyinsk and Novorossiysk, to Alexandrovsk, to Akmolinsk, to Tomsk, to Omsk, to Pinsk, to Minsk, to me the news will run. Yes, to me the news will run. And then I write by morning and night and afternoon, and pretty soon my name in Dniepropetrovsk is cursed when he finds out I published first. And who made me a big success and brought me wealth and fame? Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky is his name. Hey, Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky. I'll never forget the day my first book is published. Every chapter I stole from somewhere else. Index I copy from old Vladivostok telephone directory. This book was sensational. Pravda, Pravda. Pravda said Gil Bilka Rally Kegdatr Prinyam Vlacha Gila. It stinks. But Izvestia. Izvestia said, Ya Idukuda Sansar Yot Peshkom. It stinks. Metro Goldwyn Moskva bought the movie rights for 6 million rubles. Changing title to The Eternal Triangle, with Brigitte Bardot playing part of Hypotenuse. And who deserves the credit? And who deserves the blame? Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky is his name.
The inimitable Tom Lehrer and that piece called Lobachevsky, another send-up of his choice of my guest, the conductor Perry. So I remember we used to get into terrible trouble, Perry, in the old days at the SBC, playing things like the Masochism Tango, or worse, Poisoning Pigeons in the Park.
One of my favorites as well.
Because you can only laugh at it because it is so funny. Yes. Anyway, that's a lively, unexpected request from you. But now it's time to find out about Perry. So you were born in Hong Kong, so where did the music come from?
Well, the music was at home, actually, from the very beginning. My mother, when she was still working, she was a school teacher and taught music and language. And there was always a lot of music at church. I sang in the children's choir and fell in love with the organ, actually, very early on.
Oh, the organ.
And my legs were not long enough for a while to really reach the pedals. But once they were, I took every opportunity I could to play. And at school, I had some wonderful teachers, both of whom were choral and organ scholars at Oxford and Cambridge, who made that tradition very present and available for mm-hmm. me. So I had wonderful afternoons where I was taken out of handwriting class by my music teacher in primary school, and we would play through Bach chorale preludes together. I mean, it was really a wonderful childhood, and I was so lucky to have teachers like that. And I was also a product of an outreach program, the school's concerts by the Hong Kong Philharmonic how I first discovered the orchestra and, mm-hmm. and conducting, and sat there in the balcony thinking, I want to be that person.
The conductor.
Yes, exactly.
So the keyboard was your main instrument, as you said, the harps with an organ. And you said you came out here with the Hong Kong Youth Orchestra. Was that as a keyboard player?
So I also played the violin and the viola.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
I think I realized at some point that, there's not that much for the piano to do. There's maybe a little celeste, in a Ravel piece. But if I'm a violist, I can be in the line of great composers like Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms, you know, who all played the viola and sat right in the middle of the texture.
And Vaughan Williams.
And Vaughan Williams.
He wrote such lovely viola parts, didn't he?
And Hindemith.
And Hindemith, oh,
so
there you go.
A lot of great composers discovered that instrument. So that was it was a wonderful way to learn both the orchestral repertoire and also what it means to be an ensemble musician, how to perform with a large group of people. And in a way, it's a sentimental education for a musician to feel pride and love in your art, but also to be able to shape yourself such that you can be a good partner and a good ensemble musician.
Mm-hmm. Then how did the conducting thing happen?
As I said, I'd been very taken by the idea of this person standing in front of the orchestra. And I first got a chance to conduct my high school orchestra when our music teacher left in the middle of the year, and someone had the idea that I should be given the opportunity. And it was
bully for that person.
Thank you.
Yes.
And it was absolutely fantastic because conducting for me is a process of discovering what you can bring to the musicians in front of you.
Uh-huh.
And it's different for every group, and it's different for different corners of the repertoire. And so to have had that experience at 15 with a group of my peers, somehow being convinced by what I had to say was a really revelatory experience for me.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, but then you moved on. You've worked with some rather impressive conductors, Esa-Pekka Salonen, Lauren Marzell, and even Ido de Waart and Gustavo Dudamel, who seems to be one of the flavors of the month at the moment. So these people must also have imparted a huge amount of knowledge to you.
It's one of my favorite pastimes, actually, to find out which great conductor is in town and to see if I can sneak into a rehearsal.
Still to this day?
To this day. Because there's no textbook for conducting.
Mm-hmm.
It's it's something that evolves, I think, very much for each individual, and everyone brings something quite different to the table, and everyone has had different experiences and different toolkits.
Mm-hmm.
So to sneak in and to hear how people work with an orchestra has been fascinating, and especially so early in my career, having had the chance to work with these wonderful, great conductors, set me up in a way that I couldn't have imagined.
And you've had
otherwise.
Access to great orchestras, the Cleveland Orchestra, the Minnesota Orchestra, Houston, Detroit. I mean, these orchestras are world famous.
And they've been always very generous to me. It's wonderful being with a great orchestra because they see immediately where a young conductor is in their development. Mm-hmm. And they often are so generous about giving us what we need to develop to the next stage. And so that's also been a very, very special part of this journey.
I remember talking about these big orchestras. I remember once interviewing Charles Dutoit when he was still at Montreal, but he had just done a season with the Philadelphia Orchestra when I got a chance to interview him. And I asked him what it was like to conduct an orchestra like the Philadelphia, this huge virtuoso orchestra. And I'll never forget his answer. He said, "It's like driving a beautiful Rolls Royce. You must just change gear smoothly. Know when to speed up, know when to slow down, steer gently along, and they do the rest."
That sounds about right to me.
But sometimes I'm sure you have to work harder. I mean, for example, a few weeks ago when you did the Smetana here, that was new. Most of those movements, apart from the Moldau, were new to this orchestra, weren't they? They were having to learn the sound and the style from you, basically.
Yes, very much so. And to learn all those notes. It's quite a dense piece. And that's something that I enjoy doing very much now, taking repertoire that might not be as familiar and really establishing the style and how to think about the music, and hopefully opening a door to the orchestra as to how they might be able to love this music.
Yes, without being too dictatorial.
I think that those days are over.
Yes, they are, true.
I love the comment from Dutoit because I've always felt that the orchestra, if they decide they like you as a conductor, they will give you the key to success with them.
Ah, there you are. The key to the roles.
Precisely.
Let's have another piece of music, Perry So.
Let's have the first slow movement for Mozart's Gran Partita, the one made famous by the movie Amadeus.
Oh, yes, that was when Salieri, just remind me, he was looking at the manuscript with a sort of drone sound.
Precisely. He refers to the accompaniment as a rusty squeeze box, and suddenly out of nowhere comes this long note hovering over it on the oboe.
Thank you. There's part of that incredibly beautiful slow movement of the Grand Partita, the 13 wind instruments written by Mozart, and the choice of my guest, Perry So, the conductor who is in Cape Town with our orchestra at the moment. Perry, you said, where are you based? Where is home?
I live in Boston. I'm originally from Hong Kong and have for years tried to find a place where I want to be for a long period of time. And Boston is the right size city. It has a wonderful symphony. It also has a really active jazz scene, which I only recently discovered. Mm-hmm. And the jazz cafes are half a block away from the symphony, so you can get both in one evening.
Oh, and do you enjoy jazz?
I do.
Do you play jazz at all?
I tried to as a younger man and realized I had no talent for improvisation. But I'm riveted by the kind of imagination that it takes to be able to create this wonderful music out of nothing.
And so Boston is your home, actually.
Yes.
And do you work from Boston, or do you travel a lot then?
I travel a lot. The last couple of years, I've been lucky not to work at home.
Okay.
So whenever I'm home, I'm cooking and
have you got a
gardening.
Family, Perry?
I'm married. My wife is a professor of the history of science.
Oh boy.
And she's currently in a different city, but hopefully sometime in the future.
Does she ever come out here with you?
She's actually just been here in Cape Town with me, she's on an academic schedule, so sometimes it's difficult to organize that.
Okay. And you mentioned cooking. Is this a bit of a relaxation from the rigors of rehearsal and concerts?
Very much so. I not to be ungrateful, but as an interpretive musician, I feel like I need something of an entirely creative outlet.
Okay.
And so, putting whatever spices I do, and that's entirely something that comes out of my mind.
Is a lot of your food? This is a predictable question coming up. Is a lot of your food Chinese based?
Not at all. I'm actually a terrible, terrible cook of Chinese food. I've okay. I've never learned how to do it, and I don't know if I ever will. But I love making pasta from scratch.
Actually, literally making
yes.
the pasta.
Yes.
My goodness, that means you must be quite. Something in the kitchen.
Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
I'm sure of that. And do you ever get a chance to go back? Is your family, your parents, are they still in Hong Kong?
My parents are in Hong Kong, as are three of my siblings. So I try to visit as often as I can, and occasionally I tag on some work on either side of that. Now I just enjoy going to Hong Kong and enjoying the wonderful nature there. Mm. There's an amazing nature reserve where hundreds of species of birds stop over each winter.
Are you a bird watcher?
Yes, I love going out and seeing birds, and this has been one of the joys of being in South Africa as well.
Gosh, that must be absolutely relaxing as well.
And it's a wonderful way, especially when I'm traveling, to be able to be in touch with something other than the downtown and and the rehearsal room, and to be able to see a little bit more of the country.
And it's interesting that Hong Kong as well, one thinks of it as this vast city, sort of a New York in the middle of Asia, and yet it's got so much natural beauty around it, hasn't it?
In a way, Hong Kong and Cape Town seem to me to be sibling cities, that there's this vibrant, very quite dense downtown, which is surrounded by green. I wonder if it has something to do with the town planning of the colonial past, but it's something that I'm just very grateful for in both cities.
One of the lovely things I remember at Hong Kong is going up on the island, up on top, right at the top there, where the city is below you with the lights on, and you just hear this noise, but a nice sound of the city, but you're in the middle of nowhere up on this hill. It was magical. It's the one moment I remember most from my visits to Hong Kong.
It's especially on a quiet, cloudless night.
Absolutely.
It's beautiful.
We have to stop talking now, as much as I'm enjoying talking to Perry So. But where do you go to now after your concerts in Cape Town? What's next for you?
I'm heading home for a couple of weeks before starting work on production of Eugene Onegin.
Is that your next big thing? Where will that be?
That's going to be in New Haven in the United States.
Okay. And you're smiling because, as what you said earlier, you're clearly enjoying working on this opera, this extraordinary piece.
Yes, it's something that's not as much a part of my professional life as I would like it to be. I just having the opportunity to engage with text is really a great joy for me. So I'm hoping that I'll get to do a little bit more opera in the years to come.
There's your comparative literature coming through, and you'll bring that to your opera, won't you, in
Absolutely.
A sense, with the text. Perry, thank you, and come back again soon, and bring some Rameau.
Rodney, thank you very much for having me.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
It's back by popular demand. The West End and Broadway comedy sensation The Play That Goes Wrong returns for its final three-week season at Theatre on the Bay. Directed by me, Alan Committee, and starring eight outrageously hilarious actors, you watch how a murder mystery play literally falls apart before your eyes. Five-star reviews, full houses, and 17 touring productions around the world tell you that this play is so wrong, it's right. So come and see what's left. The Play That Goes Wrong, 9th of November to the 1st of December, Theatre on the Bay. FMR.